I'm Claire Parker.
And I'm Ashley Hamilton.
And this is Celebrity Memoir Book Club,
the podcast where we take a bunch of texts written in a foreign language, Australian, perhaps, maybe even British, and we translate it to podcast.
We are the Rosetta Stone of media in those two specific instances.
Exactly. And if you say, I would like to read it in its original text, I'm going to go back to school and learn Australian. You do that. You enjoy it. And I hope that you have a phenomenal experience. But if you want our version of the tale in the Clashley's Bible translation, stick around.
Also, thank you guys so much for bearing with us with our recent Charlotte, North Carolina date reschedule. I think we said on the last episode that we were changing Columbus. That's not true.
Yes, Columbus is still in May. Columbus, Tampa, and Fort Lauderdale are in May. And Austin is in April. And now Charlotte is June 18th.
Austin, I think we're coming to next week. So check it out. Also, if you guys want more of us, if you can't get enough, check us out on the Patreon. Also,
oh my God, we have brand new merch.
It's so good. It's our Idiot from Hell merch.
I'm so excited. So we have reissued our old merch that was RIP'd a bit too soon due to a debacle with an embezzling scandal. Not our fault. Someone else was embezzling. We would never. But if you are missing the commuter worm merch, if you miss the very smart worm merch, that is back and better than ever. And we are releasing Idiot from Hell merch, a gorgeous hat and tank to brand yourself as the sweetest little idiot that's ever risen out of hell.
Hell yeah, I'm so excited to wear it. It's one of my favorite crop tops that I own. It's like a tank top, and it was what our Y2K worm was on. That'll all be for sale, and we are so excited.
Yes. So head to, you know, the links in the show notes for tickets, for merch. It'll also be in our social media, links in bios, etc. Or, you know,
Google.
Google.
Ashley.
Yes, Claire.
Have you thought about writing a memoir recently?
I've thought about it.
Is there any story from this week that you think you'd put in there?
Well, you know, this is the week before the month, you know?
Oh.
I think that this week is preparation. Summer is coming. I think I'm going to have a really great glow up. So right now I'm a little bit on hold because we're not ready yet. You know, I've decided to become my ugliest self this winter. I didn't do like any beauty treatments or things that I'm used to. Like my hair hasn't been keratined in a long time. My face hasn't been Botoxed in a bit. And I just got it yesterday for the first time in 7 or 8 months.
Wow.
So I was feeling a bit down on myself, especially because, you know, a certain time of the month comes and you look in the mirror and you say, oh my God, what happened here? I said, nothing bad. Just wait. Just wait. Next month, everything will be different.
Excellent.
So this will be the month that I really focus on the internal because boy, oh boy, are we blossoming into a different self. It's Mercury's in retrograde. Who could even fathom going outside? It's been raining for 10 days straight.
Did you just say you're focusing on the internal self? Because like then next month is all about the external self?
Yeah. I had to focus on the internal while I wait for my bank account to prepare for the external. Claire, what about you? What's your memoir looking like lately?
Man, you guys got me fucked up.
Oh no.
Somebody recently commented on a video of me. Do you grind your teeth at night? And I know that they were trying to make me feel bad about my jawline, about muscles in my jaw.
They were trying to make you feel bad?
Yeah.
That's not nice.
Because that's not like a nice way to, like if there was a compliment, you would just say the compliment. They're doing that thing where like they were asking a leading question to be like, oh, yeah, I could tell because you're ugly and here's a way to fix it. But unfortunately, the question really got me thinking. And I don't know if I clench my jaw or not, but now my mouth is exhausted all the time. And I think the stress I'm experiencing from not knowing if I'm clenching or not, I'm like clenching out of anxiety. Do you know when you like can't remember where your tongue goes in your mouth?
Oh my God. I one time saw a YouTube video about where your tongue should go, and I spent like 2 months being like, do I even have a tongue anymore?
It's so stressful. And so now I feel like my jaw really is exhausted. And as somebody who talks professionally, those muscles are important to me. And I've been like massaging them a lot with my thumbs. Because
do you think that's why your mouth is tired?
No, I think that's why my like muscles are spasming constantly. My ligaments are like getting twisted in my throat. I can't explain it, but I'm doing some real damage in there. And I just want to detach the whole thing and put it in a Epsom salt bath. I don't know how to do a lower mouth Epsom salt bath.
I wonder if you could just drop your chin in a tub.
Maybe, but if you think about the lip of a tub, it's like 2 feet. And so now think about it this way.
But like make a tub out of a bowl.
It still is lippy.
I'm thinking about the way that I hold Bug's head in my hands sometimes.
She but likes to have no her head lip. Held. Is there a lip to your hand?
So maybe put some Epsom salt in your hand and hold your head.
Dry?
No. You know when you cup water?
That's not going to... Ashley, I've already told you two strikes. Ashley's been saying ridiculous things and I'm putting an end to it. Today, Ashley said Rebel Wilson was less a lawyer than she is. Rebel Wilson has a law degree.
We've both taken law class.
No, you haven't.
I took one.
When?
When I was in college.
No.
Okay, well, should we get into this week's book? Should we rise to the occasion?
Rebel Rising. Rebel Wilson starts chapter one, The Drive. I'm driving to Beverly Hills in my matte black Mercedes-Benz G-Wagon, which I should add has extra tint in the windows.
Okay, so I think it's really important to point out that she drives a G-Wagon because she thinks it's important for you to know that she drives a G-Wagon because anytime she refers to her car, she does not call it her car. She calls it her G-Wagon.
I'm wearing shiny Dita glasses, an expensive, lightweight Japanese brand that I heard was also a favorite of Brad Pitt. You know what this reminded me of?
What?
I remember after the success of the books, The Click, and then the success of the Gossip Girl books, really wanting to write a like tween novel series and being like, okay, the trick is you just have to list a lot of brands. And I remember being like, she took out her Juicy Couture lip gloss from her Citizens of Humanity jeans and put them into her. And I was like, okay, this is just how you write a tween hit. I was so right.
You were so right. That's how Danielle Bernstein wrote her book, remember?
I mean, literally the trick to life is just like listing things. I feel like that's how you become a fashion person on TikTok. You just like name a bunch of stuff.
That's so true. They don't even buy stuff anymore. They just do slideshows of like wish lists.
Literally, people are just like, you want to hear 10 things? And everyone's like, yes, more please.
I love knowing about
things.
And
then everyone goes, wait, but where's that shirt from? And it's like, that was literally all that was in here. How could you have questions? Anyway, I was really onto something back then. So where is she driving, you may ask?
She's driving to a doctor's office and she has to drive from her house in the Hollywood Hills past her house in West Hollywood. She has two houses, one where she just keeps all her stuff, a storage unit, if you will, but it's a house. And the other one is where she lives.
Chapter one, she's fucking saving no punches. She's just like fancy things, fancy things. She talks about how at least she has some hair. Some Hollywood actresses don't. Some of them legit have bald patches from all the styling. And then she takes her now famous swipe at Adele. She talks about how so many actresses would get offended if she called them plus size. Like Adele, for example, hates her because so many people used to mix them up. And now she can't be sure, of course, but she's like, every time I see Adele, she's so rude to me and hates me. And
I think she can be sure. She says every time they see each other at parties, Adele turns around and walks in the other direction. If there's ever been a sure sign that someone hates you, it's that they will not make eye contact with you when in your presence.
She also says this thing where she goes, there goes WME, the agency I bagged and landed an agent at my second day in America. And I'm like, well, how the fuck did you do that? And then we get to it later and go, oh, okay, well, that's kind of.
That makes sense.
I mean, that's literally true, but it's not as crazy as you make it out to be. You moved to America because they said, why don't you come over here? We'll be your agent.
Basically. So she checks in at this doctor's office where she's paying a fuck ton of money for the VIP treatment.
Which means she gets a secret side entrance, a secret sitting room.
And she's here because she wants to have a baby. She originally didn't know if she wanted babies because her mom got married pretty young at 21 and had four children. She gave us kids so much of herself that she lost parts of herself in return. I didn't want to be like that. But then here she is, 40 years old, rolling into a fertility office in her G-Wagon.
So they go, okay, you're 40 years old, you have some eggs, but really it'd be a lot easier for us to harvest these eggs if you lost weight.
Yeah, her doctor is a bitch.
Yeah, he's not very nice to her.
He doesn't even say if you lost weight. He says you'd have a much better chance if you were healthy, implying that she is unhealthy.
So she runs through her G-Wagon. I'm not a healthy person. Ha, I've always thought it's healthier to be overnourished than malnourished, right? All those anorexic Hollywood bitches are going to get osteoporosis. Whereas the tub of ice cream I'm eating every night, I'm safe from that. I'm not that unhealthy. And she's like, listen, I like work out. I feel like I'm in better shape than half of the team over at, not Glee, Aka Bitches.
Aka Pitch Perfect.
Pitch Perfect.
Then she gets into the emotional truth of it, which is that
she has an eating addiction and that she is overweight because she does, in fact, engage in a lot of destructive
emotional binge eating.
Yeah, eating patterns. I know deep down I'm engaging in unhealthy eating habits. I know that I am carrying excess weight that eventually could lead to serious disease. I know that at 39 years old, I've trashed my body with junk food. I guess because deep down, I think of myself as trash.
I emotionally eat. I overeat. I'm addicted to sugar. So she decides to make a change and she calls her agent to be like, I think I'm going to get healthier. And her agent is like, are you sure? Because she makes a lot of money as the fat friend. And so her agent just does not give a shit about her as a person. And throughout this book, really reveals herself to be a real piece of work. It feels like I'm being forced to decide, continue to have a career or get healthier and have a family. Although she's being cleverly diplomatic, Tabitha has indicated that losing weight would not be good for my career.
So now we get into Young Rebel. People are always like, what were you like as a child? I bet you were hilarious. No, not really. The truth is, I was a very shy, introverted child. This is the beginning of the story, rewinding 4 decades, and here's the origin flashback for you. So she was born to her parents who got married young.
Her mom wanted to name her Rebel after Rebel Bissacker, but her dad was like, that's crazy. So then her name was Melanie Elizabeth Bounds.
She was raised in a family. They're both like real Australian on both sides. She takes a lot of pride in her Australian lineage. I guess her great grandpa on one side was like a town's doctor that was beloved. And then on her mom's side, she comes from like a long line of
dog showers.
What kind of dog is it?
Beagles.
Yeah, she comes from a big beagle family.
And she is allergic to dogs. I mean, she never like fully says she's allergic to dogs, but she doesn't get along with the dogs and she's itchy when she's near them. Dogs were a very big thing in my family. They were the occasionally flea-ridden stars of the show. She also had lead poisoning when she was younger, but it doesn't really seem to affect anything.
Listen, I had mercury poisoning. Poisoning is just a state of mind.
That's so true. Oh, and then there's like a couple little backstory things. Her grandpa, her dad's dad was murdered when her dad was 18. Because of like a potential investigation of some kind. Her dad was kind of a odd character who worked at a bank and then was fired.
Mysteriously.
And a couple things come out later, a couple theories. He could have been doing some illegal shit.
So growing up, she was not popular. And at first they thought she was very dumb. And then slowly but surely, they started just realizing she was so shy and nervous. And they started coaxing things out of her. And she started getting actually awards at school for being good at creative writing. And then specifically, she was very good at math.
Yeah, she like found that out through horse betting.
If only they knew how weird I am on the inside, how different I am, but I'll never tell her. I'll never tell her that my parents fight and my dad gets really angry, especially when he loses money at the racetrack. I don't even tell the Bells that. So she, from a very young age, feels like she's poorer than all her other friends. She's embarrassed about how much her parents yell at each other. She's embarrassed that her dad gambles. She just feels a lot of like shame and like she's an outsider from the get-go, and it paralyzes her with fear. Also, I think it seems like from the get-go, her mom really wanted her to be a young, popular, cute, blonde girl and was always trying to set her up with people and be like, why don't you make more friends? Why don't you become more popular?
So then she was kind of weighed down by this expectation and feeling that she was disappointing her mom and not being the daughter that she wanted her to be. She would like sit inside during recess because she was so scared to talk to other kids. And at one point, her teacher was like, you have to go outside. She fake fainted to avoid going outside. And then for the rest of the year, she ate lunch in the bathroom.
I didn't realize that was a real thing.
To eat lunch in the bathroom?
Yeah, I thought they made that up in Mean Girls, but I feel like I hear about it a lot in these books. But I'm like, are they books that were written after Mean Girls?
Because I feel like their teachers had tabs on us.
I guess I also just think of all the places to eat, it wouldn't be the toilet. There's got to be a closet.
So on the weekends, her whole family would go to these dog shows, and eventually her dad started a business called Petcetera, etc., where he hooked this yellow trailer full of dog supplies onto the back of the car, and they would sell pet supplies at the dog shows. She was also a very entrepreneurial kid and like would always start businesses. So at first it was can recycling. Later it became selling sweets at the dog shows to other kids that she would like buy at the store and then resell for more.
And then eventually the other food vendors got so mad that she was stealing so much business that they shut her down because she hadn't been paying rent to have
a stall.
She had just been using her parents. And then her mom was like, well, why don't you try to become a dog handler? She's forced to compete as a junior dog handler, which is very tough on her because she doesn't care for dogs that much and she's allergic.
At one point, a boy beats her in junior dog handling, and she's like, they were just trying to encourage boys to participate, and that sucks. Why do boys always get such special treatment?
Also, when she does win, it's like $2.
Yeah.
You do it for the love of the game.
I think the grand prize was $5, and she came in second for $2.
Apart from when she was showing dogs, my mom didn't seem that happy. She didn't seem that happy with my father. I'd started to notice that he was constantly criticizing her and putting her down, telling her that she couldn't work outside the business. She had to quit her public school teaching job, that she spent too much time with us kids and not him, that she spent too much time with the dogs and not him, or that she confided in her mother too much. With him, mom couldn't win.
So then the first time she experiences her dad's temper truly and like physical abuse is when her and her sister were like burning hot one night. It was just the summer in Australia and they were so hot. So Rebel was like, I have this idea. What if we like wet all of our clothes so that we're cooler and then they're still hot? So then they wet their mattresses and the dad comes in and feels that the mattresses are soaking wet and he just wails on them. At that point, she hadn't gotten along with her sister very well. And then after her dad beat them, I removed the line dividing our room. There's no reason now to fight with my sister.
I guess at home he was angry. He could be fine for days at a time, but sometimes weeks, but the anger would always bubble up. Anger that his father was murdered when he was 18. Anger that he hadn't completed college and gotten a better job. Anger that no one knew his name. Anger that now with the arrival of my brother, he had three children to support and the stress of that weighed heavily on him.
So she's always had a very significant sweet tooth. At one point, she says the first time she remembers praying to God is when she wanted to win this Easter raffle where she would win a buck ton of chocolate eggs. And then she won. And so she was like, it was God. God gave that to me.
She wins a ton of things.
Yeah.
She seems like she's a very lucky person. She's always winning raffles and stuff. But everyone ate sweets, I thought. It was a really great way to make yourself feel better when you were sad or anxious. I numbed those feelings. We had sugar at birthday parties and Christmas. But then she's like obsessed. So she has that candy selling business. And she says she would make about $100 a weekend and then just eat all of it. She started begging her mom to let her walk to school for quote unquote exercise, but really so that she could go to the candy store on the way and then just sit with a bag of chocolate and eat it throughout the entire day. She was constantly getting in trouble for eating chocolate. And it really is very clearly like compulsive, insane amounts of sugar. And I am a fellow sugar addict.
Same. And the thing is, her mom and sister had a similar coping mechanism. The three of us were in this together. It was our form of female bonding. This was our I love you. She also gets her period. And this is just a moment where coming into adulthood, I feel like there is just such a correlation between like the amount of emotional neglect happening around that time. And then like as you become a woman, I feel like a lot of women internalize it so much more heavily. And I don't know that I've ever read any research about if there is any sort of researched correlation there. Like, I think there are a lot of studies about like specific times in life where emotional trauma embeds more heavily. And I feel like that is one. My mother loved me dearly. It's just that we don't discuss deeply personal things back then. We certainly didn't discuss things about our bodies. We didn't discuss that mom now slept downstairs in the small study whilst dad slept upstairs in the bedroom. So then she goes to this private school. Her dad had gone to the brother school and it was like a huge part of his personality. Being a king's boy was like a huge fucking deal. And so it was very important to him that his girls were Tara girls. Tara's the girls' school.
And I think the mother was like, oh, what I would have done to have gotten to be a Tara girl. So this was their big expense. And it was like, no matter how much they were struggling financially, these kids would all go to this private school.
I felt a lot of pressure because of this. Dad was literally working all day and night, working so that I could succeed and have a brand new navy colored Tara uniform.
So then she gets there. They start high school when you're 12. So she's in the equivalent of seventh grade, grade seven for my Canadian and British friends.
Oh, helpful. So she, the first week, becomes friends with these two girls who are popular. And she's like, I can't believe I'm in the popular group. And then they're like, we're going to go outside and smoke. But she doesn't smoke. And so she says, no, thank you. And then they're like, well, you're out of our group. And then she can't find other friends because it's already been like 2 weeks of school. And so the groups have formed.
I eat my lunch in the library. I will now have zero friends for the whole first year of school and it will suck.
Being invisible is better than being bullied.
And I didn't have any friends because I still had an almost paralyzing shyness. It was like puberty and all the changes brought back the shyness and anxiety. It slithered in my mind like the bush snakes would crawl onto our concrete porch at night. She, from a very early age, though, even though she's so paralyzingly shy in a social situation, is always taking to the stage. There's a local talent competition. She insists on learning how to rap.
She becomes obsessed with rap. I had no friends. My parents were increasingly bickering and money was tight. Tight because of my expensive school fees, Dad said. But I wanted to spit verse.
I became a gangsta rapper. Rappers wanted money and prestige. I wanted that too. She, from a young age, and it reminds me of Jessica Simpson, is like, I want to make more money. We already said she's very entrepreneurial. And she really relates to that, that life is about the hustle and she'll never be broke again.
Yeah, so she and her sister, they form a group called Sisters or something equally woeful. And they like enter a talent competition. In this competition, they win highly commended. They don't place, but they win an award. And then they advance to the finals later in the school holidays. Holy shit, I thought, highly commended. This was it. We needed to get a record deal. Eventually, they go to the finals and it just doesn't go well at all. They don't place. They don't get anything. And then on the way home, they pass a 7-Eleven and they're like, oh, dad, get a Slurpees, get a Slurpees, get a Slurpees. And the dad turns around and says, I'm going to choke you and kill you if you say one more thing, Melanie. I'm going to throttle you. I'm 12 years old and worse than being deemed talentless, my own father threatens to kill me over a Slurpee.
So now she's in eighth grade and she's still not really making friends. And her mom insists that she join an acting group that's just like a once a week acting class for kids. And she really doesn't want to do it, but she goes and she does the exercises. And for the first time, she really finds that it's so fun and she can't wait to go back.
So right before this, she had started to kind of make some friends and they weren't popular girls. They threw like kind of a birthday party for her. She didn't even really know them. They just kind of invited her into their circle via a birthday party. Then she gets thrown into drama class. And at first she did not want to go, but then it turned out to be a great experience. And she starts to come out of her shell.
That one weekly drama class gave me an outlet to express myself by pretending to be other people. I could hide behind the characters I was playing and act more confident. And slowly I became more confident.
And then through this interesting turn of events, so her mom had these show dogs that she would often audition for commercial gigs. And there was a play, a production of 42nd Street that one of the dogs auditioned for and didn't get. But because the mom wants to see the dog who did win, she buys Rebel and her grandma tickets to go see 42nd Street. And seeing a musical like cracks her open like an egg. I'm so happy I'm crying. It's like the music lifts me out of my seat and my soul is flying around the theater. For the entire show, I forget about all my teenage problems. The dark cloud around me dissipates and sunshine shimmers through. I mean, that's really beautiful. Like, some people never find out that they like something. Now I listen to musicals.
Now, how are you going to cozy up to read a book or listen to your favorite podcast when you are not the coziest person on earth? Luckily, Cozy Earth has everything you need to revolutionize your living space, turning it into a sanctuary of luxury and comfort. Plus, you can use the code WORM35 for up to 35% off at CozyEarth.com. Cozy Earth makes temperature-regulating bedding and the most luxurious loungewear you have ever felt on your body. I swear, the pajamas make me feel like the fanciest pajama-wearing lady in the game. I feel so, like, incredible cozied up with a book and a tea in these fancy jammies. It's truly the most incredible way I've ever treated my body. The socks will make your feet breathe a sigh of relief. You won't believe your feet could ever feel this cozy. Cozy Earth products are made from the best materials, including viscose from bamboo, and all of the products come with a 100-night sleep trial and a 10-year warranty. I'd like to paint you a picture. It is getting warmer out, spring is here, the outdoors are calling, and so imagine a day where you go out, you have lunch in the park with your friends, you walk around, you see some dogs, you smell some flowers, you see a bird or two, and after a long day out in the world, you say, okay, we've got to get home. The sun is setting. I need to cozy up. I need to make a tea. You come home, you shower off, you wrap yourself in the softest towel you've ever felt in your entire life. You put on jammies that make your skin sing, and then you curl up with a perfect book. My God, who doesn't need that in their lives? Use the code WORM35 for 35% off Cozy Earth. Again, that is WORM35 for 35% off at CozyEarth.com for the most luxurious items you've ever felt in your life.
So her mom is pretty flaky, and so her dad starts really showing up for shit, and she doesn't really understand what's going on, but she knows it's weird. And her dad starts telling her all these negative things about her mom.
Your mother doesn't love you, Dad says. She only loves the dogs. My mom loves the dogs more than she loves me. It can't be true, but when your father is saying it, you tend to believe it. If only momentarily. Dad then spends the rest of the car ride telling me how well he thinks I'm doing and how much he loves me.
My parents are fighting all the time. Mom was slowly trying to return to work as a teacher so she could have some of her own income. My father controlled all the finances, but my father was adamant she stay at home. So she also finds this bag of self-help cassette tapes in her dad's car. And she like finds all this motivating stuff. She sees this article that says when you're 15 years old, your personality is your personality for life.
For example, if you're extremely shy at 15, chances are you're never really going to overcome this as an adult. Basically, the message was that when you're young, you're still malleable.
So she's like, okay, it's too late for my dad to become a different person, but this is my year to change.
So she decides to become popular. My number one goal wasn't about losing weight. My priority was definitely to become popular at school. I mean, what teenager doesn't want to be popular? No one wants to feel lonely and be a no friends Nigel.
So these are just kind of all the tips that we say when people are like, how do I make friends in a new city? She takes it upon herself to talk to 5 people a day.
And then she like comes up with this game that everybody starts playing on the school bus that like everyone gets really involved in and becomes the morning activity.
Yeah. And she joins all these clubs. The more you're part of groups, the more you have a sense of belonging. It's also easy to make new friends because you're forced to interact and work together. So she gets really good at just like striking up conversations with new people and just asking them a couple questions about themselves. And then she like learns this trick.
It says sometimes at first you must get people's attention. Only once you've got their attention can you then turn it into something positive. So even though she had been top of her class, kind of a goody two shoes, remember she lost all those friends because she wouldn't smoke cigarettes with them. She starts becoming kind of a prankster. And the first prank is pretty mild. She gets fake cigarettes. The teacher sees a bunch of girls smoking and says, you're all going to get expelled. And then they go, you can't expel us. They're fake. And it's a big hearty har har. The next prank she does is she like pushes a teacher into a cupboard and locks her in for the entirety of class.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I was becoming a real rebel like my original name. Now I'd strut down that Terra quadrangle with swagger. All the girls would know me. Hi, Mel. I'd high five them.
So she auditions for the school play, and even though she's an underclassman, she gets a fun role. And plays they did with the boys' school, and there was like this renowned theater coach, so they were kind of allowed to do whatever they wanted. And it was definitely like the hot, cool, popular boys did. Because the productions were so high level, it was a very cool thing for the boys and the girls to do. She gets her one and only boyfriend, and then they end up breaking up because he kisses her best friend.
And then she doesn't date again for like...
ever.
Decades. And she like doesn't even care. She says, I sometimes wonder what my life would have been like if our relationship had become more serious. My sister Liberty ended up marrying a King's boy, the first she ever dated when she was 15. He did lighting at the King's Theater. That could have been me. In Liberty's case, her young love led to marriage, in my opinion, akin to my mother's story. It was an emotionally and financially abusive relationship. Tough stuff. I mean, she did eventually leave him. And now she says she loves her sister's new husband. So that's good.
Liberty has a daughter named Sovereign. Isn't that such a funny theme for a name? Founding father words. Our family name theme is Constitution.
After she gets cheated on, I didn't want anything to do with boys. I never dated anyone else throughout high school or the whole of my 20s. She has like a legendary Sweet 16 party. We don't really need to talk about this, but they invited like 200 kids, but then the word spread to other kids. And then like hundreds of kids came and like got drunk and beat the shit out of each other.
Police had to be called three separate times.
But why didn't they ever shut it down?
I guess they couldn't. I guess at the end of the day, if a teenager has no fear of an adult, then there is no difference between a teenager and an adult. She puts some of her diary entries from the time. She says, oh, if only I was a rich woman, but I know money is not the only thing in life. I really do have a strong passion for acting. I want a job with good cash and I want to do something worthwhile. She like really wants to be rich and God bless her. Her family takes one trip to the United States to go to Disneyland. And she's like, I don't even know how we afforded it. It was probably all on a credit card. And then the parents fought the whole time. I think I was so angry at mom on that USA trip for trying to act like everything was fine. Everything clearly wasn't fine. It was so frustrating.
She gets cast as a lesbian in this one play that they do called No Exit. And she's like, I can't believe my religious all-girls school is doing this play with a lesbian in it. Here I was at 16, given this incredible responsibility to play a lesbian character in an exceedingly difficult, complex play. I couldn't help but think, is there something lesbian about me? Rumor had it that one of my good friends had left the school because another girl had said that she had a crush on her. She literally changed schools to avoid a potential lesbian encounter. There's no kissing in the play, but it was like an intense moment.
She has this whole thing where she tries to be head girl and she loses to this other girl, Lucinda, who's like the more popular one. And I think it really just hits home to her that no matter how hard she tries, no matter how outgoing or funny or how many friends she makes through, what's that book? How to Win Friends and Influence.
Yeah.
That she'll never be like the tiny little blonde girl that her mom wants her to be.
She knows that getting a medical degree or a law degree is her ticket to success. So her senior year, she sits out of acting because she really wants to just focus on her exams to set herself up for the top possible future. And she's going to go to the University of New South Wales to do an arts and law double degree. But first, she gets this opportunity to be a junior ambassador and spend a year in Africa.
So she goes to South Africa with the Rotary Youth Ambassador Program.
So she does this year-long program where she's kind of just hanging out and then going on tours with the other ambassadors where they just go to different parts of Africa. She becomes best friends with this guy named Nick, who she calls Snickers, and I think is like one of her best friends to this day.
Yeah.
She does a thing I like where she really hangs on to friends.
She also says that they're like going to the local high school and they just like sit in the library all day and hang out because they've all graduated high school and they're like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, but through these tours through different parts of Africa, they get like low-key kidnapped and engaged in a smuggling scheme at one point. She also catches full-on malaria.
And while being hospitalized for malaria, she has a fever dream that she wins an Oscar. And when she comes to, she's like, no, I have to become an actress. She's like, that was my destiny. Oprah says sometimes the universe whispers. And she's like, that was the whisper.
That was the scream. She's like definitely a bit traumatized by this trip where I think she almost dies a couple of different times.
But she says it's also crazy that she's here because she like very knowingly skipped out on the family. She's like, as the oldest daughter, I felt like a lot was put on me and my family was in the middle of a horrible breakup. Like it was at the tension point where her parents were separating and a lot was expected of her as the oldest of four. And she was just like, I'm out of here. Good luck, mom and fam.
Yeah. Even her final year at high school, she moved into the boarding houses and her siblings were like, we kind of need you. And her mom calls her and is like, please help me. And she's like, I have to study.
She's like, what I will do is make a lot of money and come back and help you guys. Give me 20 years.
And she says, like, I understand it was selfish, but it was what I had to do.
And listen, when you're 17, it's not your fault that your parents are getting divorced.
And it's not your fault that your dad sucks.
So she has this vision and she comes back to Australia and she applies for this big drama school, NIDA, the National Institute of Dramatic Arts. And she goes and she auditions and immediately she's rejected. I walked to the bus stop trying not to cry, even though the rejection stung worse than 100 wasps. I do want to, spoiler alert, she gets rejected 5 times and you can only audition once a year. So for 5 years in a row, she's just getting rejected.
Oh, and there was a situation in Africa where she did get stung by like a fuck ton of wasps. It's not a euphemism for what hurt more. She has actually experienced getting stung by 100 wasps and also getting rejected 5 times.
So she studied karate and while she was in South Africa, she goes to a dojo and represents them in a competition and gets sucker punched. I'm like, why is she telling us this story? Who cares? And then it turns out she goes, quote, when I think back on this story, I feel like it was a bit of a metaphor for a lot of my life. There were times when I was metaphorically punched unfairly in the face. In most of these situations, I would just cry and not fight back. But then came 2015.
So in 2015, she was slandered heinously by Australian media and she fought back.
So it's so funny. We know these women who have a huge podcast network in Australia called Shameless Media. They were the first ones I heard use this phrase called tallest poppy syndrome. I think it's an Australian phrase. And basically, it's to talk about when like somebody's doing well, everyone else wants to cut them down. I guess it's a real epidemic over in Australia. I feel like in America, we don't have a phrase for it. It's just haters gonna hate.
Yeah, that's a phrase.
Yeah, but I feel like tall poppy syndrome is really getting to the root of something.
Because we always say if haters gonna hate and watch the money pile up.
50 told me, go ahead, switch your style up. And if they hate, let them hate and watch the money pile up.
Yeah, that's what I said. Okay, so basically what happened, and this is actually important because I think a lot of this stuff cut way deeper than I realized, but Bauer Media put out some articles around the time that Pitch Perfect 2 came out, alleging that she was lying about basically everything. She was lying about her name. She was lying about her age. She was lying about her history. And she was just like a terrible person who lies about everything. And this is very interesting because we, a couple days ago, posted a TikTok about this book coming out. And a couple of the comments were, I don't believe anything Rebel says. She's a liar.
Okay, and you know what's funny? She's a known liar. I don't know anything about her, really. I was shocked reading this book, how many movies she's been in. It was just one of those things I had never strung it together to realize how successful and big she is. But vaguely in the back of my head, I was like, oh, yeah, didn't she, like, lie about her age? Like, there was something in my head that went, I cannot believe the way they came for her and really fucked up her reputation.
Publicly branding me as a serial liar was an extremely serious thing to put against the plaintiff and not without a legitimate basis. Essentially, they've branded her a serial liar purposefully with malice.
They attacked my authenticity, which is something I hold very dear. They claimed my life wasn't really my life. And then it turned out the main source for all this information was like a girl from her high school who just fucking hated her.
Yeah.
What a loser. And everybody was like, no, we've like noticed it for years. She is obsessed with being like, why is Rebel famous? I hate her.
And it's so crazy because I also had that experience where I was like, I actually don't know a ton about Rebel Wilson's personal life. There was some stuff in this book that I thought was like a huge revelation. And then I went to her Instagram and I was like, oh my God, is she like revealing in this book that she has a child? But it's just out there. I just don't follow Rebel Wilson news very much.
I wonder who does.
But 11 million people on Instagram. Yeah,
but who are those people?
But what I was going to say is one of the things I did not know that for like a couple of years, she's publicly had a child, but I didn't know this story that she lied about her age.
Yeah.
So that company, I mean, she did deserve to win that lawsuit. They really fucked her up. She says she was having like a gangbusters year and a bunch of opportunities dried up. And then things started to get going again once they settled this lawsuit. But once you put that kind of information out there about someone, it's hard to walk it back. Exemplified by the fact that we did not know that it had been walked back.
Also, I didn't even realize I knew it.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't until she brought it up that I went, oh yeah. She's a liar. I mean, one of the things they accused her of lying about is having a dad who died. That's an insane accusation. Like, why didn't they Google it?
And especially if their main source of her lying about her age was a girl that she went to school with.
Why not ask a second girl?
But also, what age is that girl? They're all the same age.
It does seem like Rebel lied about her age.
Well, she said she was cagey about her age.
Yeah.
And she's like, I don't know, that's a smart thing to do in Hollywood, which I would agree with. She got to Los Angeles when she was like 29. I feel like if people are like, how old are you? And you're like, I'm in my 20s. And they guess 24, go with it.
She also was like, they claimed I lied about my name. And she's like, yeah, I don't know. You're right. I changed my name before I came to Hollywood. She uses her mother's maiden name and then Rebel, which she always felt like was her nickname.
Yeah. And she also legally changed it before she ever went to Hollywood.
I also am just like, okay, I'm sorry. Should we put Jax Taylor in jail for that lie?
I mean, should Emma Stone go to jail because her name is Emily?
You guys famously know that I think the biggest mistake of Ashley's life was not changing her name before she started stand-up.
We all know. We all know and agree.
Ashley's mom called her Brock growing up, short for broccoli.
Yeah.
And she's always like, should I have been Brock Hamilton? And I was like, of course. If you had been Brock Hamilton, this podcast wouldn't exist because we'd be reading your book.
I'm sorry.
You would be Rebel Wilson, who had touched the stars and come back down to earth.
I'm sorry.
I guess I have nothing to do but win because you wouldn't have known me. You wouldn't have known my sorry ass.
So then we go back to a diary entry. She gets rejected from Nita again for the fourth time. She's not dating because she's focusing on her career. She thinks God won't even give her a break. It's embarrassing getting rejected for the fourth year in a row. So instead, she like writes her own play and puts on her own play, which does get her noticed.
That's my new phrase, gangbusters.
People love that about her. She feels kind of shitty about herself because she has actually no money. Like, she is broke as a joke, sleeping on the floor in her sister's room because there's no room for her in her mom's new apartment because their dad kind of like wiped out the money.
And her mom's like, well, you're supposed to be in college, so you don't get one of the bedrooms, which is legit.
Yeah. And so at that point, she's taking classes for her law school degree, but she's not a full-time law student ever.
Yeah, so she's a part-time law student. She's still taking acting classes, and then she's working to try to like pay for both. So she writes these things called the Westie Monologues. I wrote it in 2 nights whilst also working a reception job at the Australian Theatre for Young People. The play is 5 girls playing 13 different characters that are all based on either my life or people I knew growing up in the western suburbs of Sydney.
She gets rejected from Nita for the 5th time.
She used her $2,000 that she had saved to produce it, and it ended up becoming a huge hit at the Sydney Fringe Festival, and it goes on to play at the Belvoir Street Theatre, and then executives on a television station gave her $90,000 to put it on professionally. That's incredible. Could you imagine if someone gave us $90,000?
I don't know what I'd do with it.
And then somebody came to see her, a TV writer, director, actor named Paul Fenech. And he says, do you want to be in my new feature film? Fat Pizza.
So then she's in Fat Pizza.
And then Fat Pizza becomes a TV show.
And her character in Fat Pizza is such a big deal that she is a regular on that TV show.
And she's still getting rejected from that fucking acting academy, Nita.
Yeah.
Let that be a lesson. Don't wait for somebody to give you permission. Don't wait for somebody random to say you're good enough. You have to make your own opportunities. This bitch was literally starring on a major TV show and like still hoping to get into acting school.
So she is on this show called Fat Pizza. I'm like legit fat now and I have pains in my stomach. I've put on about 66 pounds, 30 kilos in the last year.
She's also noticing that her arms are getting hairier and she's like, what the hell is going on?
So then she finds out she has PCOS.
They don't even really tell her anything about it. They're just like, hey, take this pill for the rest of your life. Good luck out there.
People really don't want women to understand what their bodies are.
And her mom are clashing more and more every day. Her mom also struggles with her own weight, and it seems like she's really projecting frustration at Rebel for Rebel gaining weight. With all the constant rejection, trying to be an actress, and the constant stress of trying to earn money and keep up with law school, the ice cream is the only thing that's keeping me going. But when she goes home, her mom screams, you're not having it. You do not need it.
But now I have money and amazingly no debt. So she, because of this job, because of the play, she like finally gets herself out of credit card debt. She gets her own apartment. And then she decides to spend $35,000 to take her siblings and her mom on a trip to America and Thailand.
They spend time in New York. They go to Washington, D.C. to see the White House. What kind of fucking PR was the White House Tourism Board doing in the goddamn 90s? Or I guess this is the 2000s. Because I cannot fathom flying from Australia and making a weekend trip to see. I don't even want to see the White House. I go to D.C. regularly.
Can I say the way we view travel versus the way people in other countries? Because like Australians are so gung-ho to just like go places.
I guess the thing about Australia is you just have to eat it that if you want to go anywhere, it's going to be a while.
Yeah.
So they're like just like more down with it. But I'm sorry. If you are from another country and you want to come to the United States and look at the White House, Google it. That's it. It's that, but in real life.
Yeah, you can't even really stand near it.
There's no reason to go see it.
The Easter egg hunt on the lawn is not open to the public.
So don't go on Easter thinking you'll meet Joe Biden.
He laid all those eggs and they're not for you.
But it really does boggle the mind to me. So they go to New York, DC, and they're all sharing one room and they're like coming in at different periods of the day so that the hotel doesn't realize how many people they're cramming into a single room. Because they must be a family of six at this point. And I just want to say, how about you get two rooms and don't go to DC? But then they go to Thailand. I'm like, is that on the way? That feels like...
I guess it's on the way back to Australia.
I guess. I just feel like when I try to go to Thailand, that was its own feat. It took me 24 hours to get there. It turns out I went the wrong way. When she's putting on the Westie monologues, she has a friend named Lucy, who's a fantastic and endearing actress in the show, and she would get a ton of laughs, more laughs than me. Sometimes I'd watch her and think, why is she getting more laughs? I'd written the roles fairly equally in terms of jokes. She was brilliant, but I also realized that had something to do with her size. People like to laugh at people they don't want to sleep with. She decides that the reason her friend is funnier is that she's fatter, and this like gives herself permission to just gain as much weight as possible for her career, which I kind of think is an interesting turn of thought.
Yeah.
It is interesting to look at somebody and go, well, what scientific reason would somebody think they're funnier than me? I took a class. They said it's because you're fat. That's the only thing you have on me that makes you funnier. I'm going to get fatter and then I'll be the funniest.
But I feel like as inappropriate as it is, I feel like they say it all the time on like 30 Rock or something. Remember when Jenna gains weight and Alec Baldwin is like, you have to like gain 60 or lose 30?
Yeah.
That is like a very true train of thought, which I don't think has to be real, but it's perpetuated by Hollywood.
Yeah.
Heavily. So mom refuses to allow fat pizza to play in the house. She doesn't want to see it because I look gross and she disapproves of my swearing in it. Her mom is really unhappy that she's famous for like making fun of herself. I was determined, though, to give my character some more depth. I also tried to hold my own among the guys, mainly improving my own lines, hoping to get one joke on camera during a 12-hour workday, because trust me, no one is going to hand you amazing jokes or material. I was in a boys' show, so I had to take their fatphobic jokes right on my double chin.
But then the creator, the guy who found her, goes, you try too much. And she's like, what you don't understand is as a woman, for me to even be considered funny, I have to try 10 times as hard as you. I have to try to do 10 times as many jokes to hope half as many get into the final cut because you guys just don't think women are funny.
And then she gets invited to do this sketch show where she'll be writing and acting in it. I guess it's like Australian SNL.
It's called The Wedge. I don't think it is because it only lasts for 2 seasons.
Okay.
I think it's like Australian mad TV.
She also like was trying stand-up at one point to get noticed a little bit more. And then as soon as she got The Wedge, she was like, okay, I'm done. I don't need to do that anymore.
When she was cast on The Wedge, she was the only female writer performer employed on the show. And very quickly, two of her characters, Lucy and Fat Mandy, become like the number one sketches on the show, the crowd favorite. And it makes the other men very mad. They say that she's getting too big for her boots. They're really into having women in bikinis. And they say the funniest thing a woman can do is be in a bikini. They're like really disgusting, misogynistic. They're spending all of the show money on strippers and doing cocaine.
And so she moves to Melbourne for this show and they're just like not in season two. She negotiates for a little bit more money, but they just stop putting her on air. She's like barely in any sketches. She's just like laying on the floor of her dressing room all the time. And finally she confronts one of the producers and then there's just like nothing they can do. And of course the show gets canceled because it sucks the second season because they're too prideful and obsessed with strippers to like put actually funny shit on the air.
So she has this show she's done called Bogan Pride.
So she says only 2 people a year get the golden opportunity to have their own TV show in Australia. And at 28, she finally gets the opportunity. This is a line that I would classify as one of her few like deeply out of touch moments. I feel like for the most part, when she like flashes her wealth and her fancy things, she is doing it out of a way to be like, I know you want to know what cool shit celebrities have. So I'm telling you.
She's just telling you the numbers. Who doesn't want to know the numbers? I love that she tells numbers.
Exactly. Or it's like a little bit tongue in cheek, like aware of her own shit when she's like, yeah, I have 2 houses in LA because I had too much stuff for 1 house. She knows that she sounds like that. But this part being like, finally, my chance at 28. I'm just like, ah, relax. So she makes a show called Bogan Pride. I don't know if we've already explained it, but a bogan is like Australian white trash, she says.
And apparently does really well. And then it kind of gets big in Hollywood. Apparently the comedy writers of Hollywood are passing around a DVD of it. It's getting a good laugh. And she has a meeting with somebody from WME, which is one of the big, I guess now we're down to 3.
Yeah, one of the big 3 talent agencies.
And they're like, you know, if you came to America, I think we'd like to represent you. This is why when she's like, can you believe at my second day in America, I got an agent at WME? And I'm like, well, I guess I can because you went specifically because they said if you come here, we'll represent you.
Yeah. And your meeting wasn't the first day because that is just like a lot for one day to travel quite a far way and have a meeting also that day.
I had to wait until I finished law school to go, even though I was probably the most recognizable actress in Australian comedy at this point after appearing on 13 different TV shows. There was still something inside me that said, graduate law school. You never know when you might need that. What was supposed to be a 5-year double degree from the University of New South Wales took me 10 years to complete.
See, this is why I balk at her obsession with being like, and I'm a lawyer. I guess that she is. She finished law school and I'm proud of her for that.
I'm not going to give it to you. I don't know what else you want from someone.
Okay, that was another thing in the Rebel Wilson lore is people are obsessed with calling her a lawyer. I won't compare me. But anyway, okay, what I'm saying is I think a huge part of experience is having an experience. Like, she never practiced law is Fair what enough. I mean.
Yes.
Lots of people go to law school. And I think that if you've never practiced law, calling yourself a lawyer is a, like, that's why I was like, well, I call myself a lawyer. Both Rebel Wilson and I have practiced law the same amount of days.
Before this show goes, she's more lawyer than Portia de Rossi, but less lawyer than me.
I'm kidding. Except for about the Portia de Rossi thing.
But I will say, like, in comparison, I think there's so many celebrities who are like, when I was in second grade, I wanted to be a lawyer. And then later they're like 32 on the come down from winning an Oscar being like, whatever happened to that little kid who wanted to be a lawyer? When did I give up on my lawyer dreams?
Oh, no, it's always like marine biology.
The millennial dream. I do think it is interesting, and I will give her credit for the fact that she was very successful at acting and still going to class. That's crazy.
That is crazy.
To have your own fucking TV show that you wrote, produced, direct, starred in, and still be showing up for class.
And to say, like, hold on, WME, I'll come to America as soon as I finish law school. I'll give her that. I give her almost everything else in this book. That was my one qualm.
And at this point, her mom is still not supportive of her being an actress. Why would you want to be a woman who is laughed at?
I think her mom still sees it as her being laughed at.
Why would you want to wear short shorts so that your fat thighs are on display? Why would you want to make yourself look uglier than you actually are? Why would you want to be loud and draw attention to yourself? Mom didn't get it.
It's so sad. It's so sad because her mom is the nice one.
Yeah.
So then she sells everything she owns to go to Hollywood for this meeting. The thing is, like you said, this wasn't like an out of nowhere meeting. She has a ton of experiences. She was even, I guess, the movie Ghost Rider with Nicolas Cage filmed in Australia, and she was in a scene of it. And I think this was an interesting part. I was instructed not to comment on Nicolas Cage's hair. And in the first minute of meeting him, an actual Hollywood star, I touched his hair and realized it was a wig. This, I think, is interesting because remember in Seth Rogen's book when Nicolas Cage was obsessed with like having drawn on Sharpie hair?
That's a memoir I want. And I want like 6 chapters about his hair. Men and their hair.
Men and their hair.
Andre Agassi.
Can I say, I'm waiting for Nicolas Cage's hair to be like the O.J. Simpson trial in the way that it like comes through in so many memoirs. And it's something that I'd never really thought about before. But the way
but
that
if you're
we're
in
like,
Hollywood long enough, you will have a Nicolas Cage hair story.
I think every single book is going to have a Nicolas Cage story in 9/11 or an O.J. Simpson trial experience.
Can I say, it's not history. It's not her story. It's the Nicolas Cage hair story.
Ain't that the truth?
So she moves to LA and she crashes on the couch of a fellow Australian actress named Monique, who used to also be a plus size actress. And since coming to LA seems to have lost a lot of weight and then also struggled to find any work. It turns out she's in Overeaters Anonymous. And so it was very difficult for her when Rebel showed up and most of her suitcase was Caramello Koalas. It was very triggering for her to have that much sugar in the house.
She's thinking about dating again a little bit. She's quite lonely. And then she says, no, change your mindset. I'm not lonely. I'm focused. I have to sacrifice. No social life, no love life, no worries.
I will not have a romantic distraction. I do not want a partner who, like my father and mother's relationship, might come into my life only to destroy me.
So she goes to her meeting at WME and they agree to sign her. One of her big things is that she wants to be the female Jonah Hill. She says it a lot. I don't think she knew that he was like a really bad person.
Yeah.
So they sign her because she is unique. And she's like, wow, me, unique. And they immediately start sending her on like meetings. I think in her first couple of days in LA, she has lunch with like Amy Poehler and Jason Segel.
And who's that famous casting director that everybody loves?
I forgot, but she meets
Allison Jones.
Yes. Monique is immediately like, what the fuck? You got signed by WME and you've been here for a day and a half?
The fact that things were happening for me seemed to boggle her. It seemed to make her more neurotic with her eating. I understand that she feels competitive with this woman, but I also think at this point she can say she won.
Yeah, I don't think we need to like talk about Monique's eating.
There is like a few mentions of Monique being like, wow, I get that Rebel was looking at through the lens of like a competitive weight thing. But also I'm like, I don't know, Rebel, this poor girl has been hacking it in LA for years. And you showed up and on the third day, have like a meeting with the number one casting director in Hollywood.
Yeah, so then she gets set up on all these general meetings. I was going to be entertaining AF. You never know where a general meeting can lead.
My 30th audition, close to my 30th birthday, was for a comedy film called Bridesmaids.
Oh, wait, she also, I want to say, like, some of the things she tested for, within the first couple of weeks, she tested for a TV pilot with Deborah Messing, which, like, testing for a pilot means you have gotten so far. Yeah. She wasn't just auditioning. She was, like, in sound stages, in rooms with, like, huge producers and actresses.
Oh, she had multiple auditions to be in We Bought a Zoo. The role ended up going to Scarlett Johansson. Like, why was she even considered for that? If a role is ever played by Scarlett Johansson, why are they pretending it could have ever been?
Rebel Wilson?
Yeah.
I guess they weren't sure, like, what it takes to run a zoo.
I guess they were like, okay, well, we have Matt Damon, so now we need a hot one. They're like, what direction is this comedy about owning a zoo going in? And they're like, I guess sexy? I guess this is kind of like a sexy story at its core. So she ends up getting to be in this movie. She's originally auditioning for the role that Melissa McCarthy gets. And she's like, I knew that Melissa McCarthy was going to get it. They wanted her to have it. You can't beat Melissa at her own goddamn game.
She was also like close friends with Kristen Wiig.
Yeah, Melissa. So they gave her the role that we end up seeing her in, which is sibling to this guy, Matt Lucas, who was a huge comedy hero of hers. And they end up having so much fun and she ad-libs so much. And it becomes what they call a breakout.
Yeah. So they record this movie. She and Matt Lucas become great friends. And he even is like, oh, when my house is done being renovated, you should move in with me. So that's like a great opportunity that she has coming her way to like not live in like a shitty Hollywood apartment that's cheap anymore. But she then has like one horrible year after filming Bridesmaids where the movie hasn't come out yet. No one really knows who she is. She doesn't know many people in Hollywood and she's living in this shitty apartment still.
I don't even think it was a horrible year. I think it was just lonely.
That sounds horrible to me.
She's getting work. She's working on Workaholics. Little things are happening here and there, but mostly she's alone in her own apartment.
She says every month after she paid rent, she'd only have $60 to live on. It was one of the loneliest years of my life. I really didn't know anyone. Monique moved back to Australia. She was just like going on walks and binge eating.
Yeah, she was in a really bad binge eating cycle.
I was surviving in America on not much money and it was shitty. I wasn't socializing, so there was no one to snap me out of it. There was no one to witness my terrible habits, so they just got worse.
But then she has this breakthrough role and then everything changes. And then she gets the Facebook message of my dreams.
Yeah, but hold on. I want to say one other thing. So then a lot is riding on this role. And like the fact that it was a breakout sensation, I feel like is another one of her lottery wins.
For her to be in four scenes in a movie where every scene has like a female powerhouse comedian.
Yes. And I feel like there are so many people who move to LA and like get a gig. We always say there is no breakout moment. It's all these little moments that lead to something. And of course, she did have like 13 TV shows in Australia. And she did have all these little moments that led to something. But the fact that her first American role was like this breakout sensation is kind of crazy. Okay, so then she gets this Facebook message.
It's from Kay Cannon, who wrote something called Pitch Perfect and has a character called Fat Amy. And she's like, no offense, do you think you'd like to do it? And she's like, no offense, I love it.
If you can guess, Fat Amy is a sensation.
She goes, and it really does sound like working on Pitch Perfect is exactly what you hope every group of friends on a film set has. It's just like sleeping at camp. Everybody's not that big of a star. The only real star is Anna Kendrick, which I don't know. She seems like a pill, but everyone's having so much fun. They do 3 months of filming on location in Louisiana. She gets paid SAG rate, which is like the lowest amount you can, which is $65,000. But it's the time of her life.
And I think they're all still like best friends.
Yeah, they all end up going to her 40th birthday party. And so this film was made for $15 million. And they thought it was just gonna be some small like summer camp hit.
And it was, I mean, I don't know if you guys have seen it. It's an incredible film.
She loves Adam Devine.
Divine.
I call him what I want to call him.
Okay.
I call him that beautiful woman's husband.
So they actually didn't even have scenes together, but they'd worked together on Workaholics and gotten along really
well.
Can I
say, I feel like that's a rabbit hole a lot of people have been on.
What?
Adam Devine's wife.
That's so true.
And the way that steak tooth, I'm like, that's somebody that everybody had a Sunday afternoon where they went, who's this woman? And then just spent a lot of hours being like, ah, and then she graduated Columbia. Good for her.
ELL girls know.
Oh, was she in that?
Yeah.
Big time or little time?
Important, small to medium amount of time.
Got it.
Key roles that you don't see that often. Mm. But anyway, so Bumper and Fat Amy don't have any lines together in the script, but then they were like kind of around each other because of the way the a cappella groups interacted and they improvised so well together that the director was like, yeah, go off. And it obviously ended up blossoming into such an important romance.
And then she's really hurt that he's sleeping with somebody else on the set. Funny guys don't want to sleep with funny girls. I wanted to sleep with funny guys, though. But I was so behind the eight ball on dating and a love life that I just tried to forget my urges. I could barely have a proper off-camera conversation with Adam because I thought he was so cute. Listen, you're allowed to be mad that he's fucking some other girl. And I'm not saying if you had talked to him, it would have been you. But it is funny to be like, of course, she gets to fuck him. The one who can have a conversation with him. So she talks about being on this set and just feeling so confident and just the irony of playing this sexually promiscuous, confident woman when she herself is so protected. She's actually a virgin until she's 35 and nobody knows this about her.
She also was like constantly called brave for like existing on screen as a fat woman. People would come up to me in the street and say, I want to thank you for being so brave.
She's having fun and she's coming into her own and she loves the stylist for taking care of her, but there's part of her that it's eating at her. And when she gets home from the shoot, she like falls into a deep depression
mm-hmm.
because she went from this incredible experience to then squat.
Being back alone in LA. And I also want to say one other little tidbit. Did you know Esther? What's her name?
I am obsessed with, this is the memoir I want.
Okay. Esther Dean, who is in Pitch Perfect, apparently is an incredible songwriter and in negotiations to have her songs be a cappella versioned in Pitch Perfect. She like negotiated a role for herself as one of the Bellas, which is awesome. And so then I went down a rabbit hole to look up what songs she wrote.
Oh
and
God,
it's all the good ones. I thought Rebel Wilson was just being nice when she's like, if you've ever heard a good song, it was written by my friend Esther.
No,
I was like, sure, everyone says
that.
When
you Google it, it was like she wrote these four songs and then 114 others. And they're
Countdown by Beyonce, for Christ's sake.
S&M by Rihanna.
Rude Boy too, I think.
I mean, she's done a lot for Rihanna. Katy Perry, Firework.
Like for literally everyone. She did Pills and Potions by Nicki Minaj.
Anyway, Esther Dean, if you're listening,
you're my hero.
So she's having the time of her life. She's working really hard on set. When she's not working hard on set, she's writing her own shit because Amy Poehler said, listen, you must generate your own work. No one's just going to hand you an amazing opportunity. You have to create it for yourself.
That's incredible advice.
So even though she's working 16, 17 hour days, she's going home on the weekend. She's going home at night and everyone else is going out and partying. And her and Esther are writing. Esther is writing the next biggest hit you've ever heard.
And she's writing Super Fun Night, a sitcom that eventually gets picked
no
up.
No one's ever heard of.
I do remember it, kind of. But it was during that period of time where I was circling stuff in Entertainment Weekly.
That's not Pills and Potions. So then she talks about at one point, she's working so hard and so stressed and she has one solo and she's so nervous. She doesn't sleep all night. And then she wakes up and has bronchitis and they have to come and give her steroids. And she's obviously kind of a no drinking, no drugs type person. But she lets them do it because she knows in that situation, it'll cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars to not. The show has to go on. We know that from Stephanie Tanner's memoir.
Exactly.
No one can take a day off sick because it costs so much money. And so then she kind of has this thing about being like, so every story you've heard about what they're doing to these kids, like the Judy Garland stories of the uppers and the downers, they're definitely true because they came over. She's like, one time I went to the hospital with a concussion and they were like, cool, you ready to shoot though?
Yeah. And she talks about how finally when she was 36 years old on Pitch Perfect 3, she had done 15 takes of this one scene and it was the middle of the night and she was freezing cold. And finally they were like, okay, let's line it up to take it again. And she goes, no, I'm done. It took her until she was 36 years old to be like, it's so cold out. You have to have gotten the shot.
And
this is crazy.
It seems to have come from a place of the director herself did not know what she wanted.
Yeah.
And that's not fair to take out on your actors. Pitch Perfect was released September 28th, 2012. This was the day my life changed forever. This was the day I instantly became internationally famous. And she talks about how she can't even fathom becoming famous when you're young because it changes everything so quick. The way that everybody suddenly, like your life does change. Suddenly she's hanging out with Julie Roberts. Suddenly she's going to A-list parties. Suddenly everybody knows her. And even if she has a hat on, she can't go to the grocery store without having somebody take a selfie.
She says there are like some huge ups, like you get invited to such cool shit and you get free shit all the time. But then there are obviously what we know of as the downs. You lose your privacy. The other part is this enormous pressure you suddenly feel. Am I worthy of success? Am I good enough? Am I deserving of all this acclaim? How am I going to keep up this level of success?
So Super Fun Night gets picked up and I don't know what really happened here, but she keeps being like, they didn't really know me and I was so young. And I'm like, I think you were 33.
Well, she says that at the beginning, they kept being like, it's your show, do what you want. And then as they like got further into production, they kept on just kind of like walking all over her and she didn't know how to stand up for her vision. And she says that like the other producers that they kind of assigned and the other showrunner that they assigned, like just did not really understand what she was going for with this show. And so it became kind of a mess. Also, 2 weeks before the show was set to start production, her dad dies.
So now she gets into a relationship with her dad. Her parents went through a really, really, really messy separation. They never ultimately got divorced, but they were separated. And it seems like the legal battle went on for about 7 years. The dad took the business, the dad took the house. the kids were all like scraping by in some tiny apartment. They couldn't afford the electricity all the time. And he bought himself a Mercedes.
He also was abusive.
Yeah. But for 7 years, he really took their mom to the cleaners and left her with nothing and made sure the legal bills kind of soaked her dry and didn't come by often and wasn't very nice. And she never really reconnected with him. It seems like the two younger kids had to go over every weekend and spend weekends with their dad. And the mom really wanted them to keep a relationship, but the older kids, she couldn't. Like, they knew too much. And so when she moved to America, she wasn't really speaking to him. Emails here and there, but he comes to LA with the brother and they just go out to eat. And she's like, I didn't even want to show him my house. So the last conversation they ever have is like on the street.
Yeah, where she's like, okay, see you later. He comes to like a Pitch Perfect premiere that she does in Australia or a big screening, and they like hug, and she talks about how awkward it was to kind of see him there and how she didn't want to invite him to the celebration afterwards. He was obviously very proud of her, but she felt very weird about him sharing in her success because of the emotional trauma.
So she goes home, she goes to the funeral, she writes him a letter that she puts in his casket that gets cremated with him. But that is a lot to come back from.
Mm-hmm.
To have your dad die and then have to go into full-time production.
Yeah, I mean, she then comes back and she has 1 week before she goes into production on a TV show that is like her name.
So then we have this chapter, Sacha Baron Cohen and Other Assholes. And this is honestly a takedown of Sacha Baron Cohen and fuck him, because
I want to say this line, I rue the day that I met Sacha Baron Cohen. I fucking love the word rue.
So the first time she meets him is at a dinner party that her friend Matt Lucas is hosting at the house where she's living. He has people over all the time, but she's so excited about meeting Sacha Baron Cohen because he was one of her comedy idols. So she is about to host the MTV VMAs and he had hosted it one time. So he goes, well, why don't you practice your jokes on us and we'll tell you if we think they're good or not. She does her jokes and he sits there dead silent and then just goes, wow, you're in trouble. She panics, hires a bunch of writers, one of whom is Ali Wong.
Good to know. She's a great writer.
And then she starts like running them all over city, trying out her jokes and realizes the jokes she had written were going well with regular audiences. So she's like, okay, why did he fuck my head up like that?
Oh, wait. I also want to say at the beginning of this chapter, she talks about all the other people she'd met who were awesome. And one of them is Russell Brand. So it really is one of those things where I'm like happy for this takedown of Sacha Baron Cohen. But this whole thing of like all these other people were nice to me. Just don't name the nice ones because they'll go down too.
So now it's a year later, she gets a phone call. It's him. He's begging her to be in his new movie, The Brothers Grimm, right? Or
The Brothers Grimly. Grimsby.
And she's like, he is love bombing me. He's like, you're so funny. You're the only one. I need you in it. And of course, she's honored. She shows up. They do a reading. Brad Pitt is there. Brad Pitt doesn't even end up being in the movies. But she later realizes that he had stacked this table read with all of his most famous friends who like are guffawing at everything. To make it seem funnier than it is.
Yeah, she really points out what a calculated little mofo he is. In some sense, they'd say, oh, that was actually good business advice. But he's a calculated little bitch.
So then, day one, she ad-libs something, as is her prerogative. It gets a big laugh from the crew. And she's like, to make the boom guy laugh is actually a big deal. They are pretty hardened.
Their whole job is to stay pretty still.
And she's like, oh, hell yeah, I'm feeling good. And then is shocked when they come back to the set to retake the scene. And he has now stolen that line and done it as himself. And she starts realizing he's doing that a lot, that a lot of his lines are either stolen ad-libs from other people or bits his friends wrote. And she's like, I never see him on his own be a comedic genius.
Yeah, I've never seen him improvise anything. And then there's this one thing that he really wants her to do, which is like in part of a soccer scene, he wants her to run across the field naked and she does not want to do it. She's like, there's no reason to have this scene where my character streaks across the field. And she says, every day I had to have this conversation with him. It was in no way essential to the plot that my character run naked onto a soccer field. It seemed that he could see the notion of this made me uncomfortable, so he kept pushing me to do this.
And then she says every day he's picking on her wardrobe and making her change into smaller and tinier clothes. I know making yourself unattractive is a device in comedy, but this felt personal. Like he just wanted me to look and feel awful.
She says it didn't feel like they were laughing with each other in the way that with Fat Amy, she has a lot of control over this character. She felt like he was trying to humiliate her.
And then he's always doing weird sexual things like saying they should do paparazzi pics on a boat making out to help promote the movie. And she's like, I really don't want to do that. Everything he's saying to her is gross. It's derogatory to women or to her size. And then one day, a PA comes and says, oh, Sasha wants to do a scene with you down in the basement.
So they're at this soccer field and there's a room in the basement that's like really creepy and there's a mattress in it. And she goes down there. No one from the actual camera crew is there. Neither is the director, Lewis. So how is this a scene for the film? The only people in the room were SBC and his mates.
Okay, well, we're going to film this extra scene. Then he pulls his pants down while his friends stand there awkwardly and record the whole thing on their iPhones. He says, okay, now I want you to stick a finger up my ass. And she's like, no. And he keeps pressuring her. And she keeps being like, I don't want to. Nobody is there. He keeps insisting.
And then she just like kind of smacks his ass and improvs a line and then leaves.
And when she calls Tabitha, her fucking agent, about it, she's like, oh yeah, we've heard stories like that. But don't leave. You don't want to look unprofessional.
So she's like, I should have been able to quit the film. Like, this was insane and so unprofessional and such harassment.
But Tabitha also represents SBC.
Yeah.
And she's kind of like, well, he didn't touch you. So maybe just like finish the film. And then if he does something again, then it's bad.
So then a couple months later, she gets this call that they're doing reshoots and she's going to have to do this raunchy sex scene with Sacha Baron Cohen. And she's like, what the fuck? First, Tabitha's like, well, I don't know. What are you going to do?
She goes, why don't you have this conversation with him face to face? And she's like, I don't want to do that. And they're like, no, the producer will be there. The female producer will be there. She sits down to the conference room. It's all the men and Sacha Baron Cohen on one side of the table. She's alone on the other side. And the woman producer is not there.
So she is feeling like she's the problem. If she doesn't film the scene, then she's the reason that the film isn't working. Like, they're really pressuring her in all of these ways.
And so her lawyer sends a letter being like, she will not do nudity. She will not do anything with a sex toy, like no dildos, nothing. And they act like she's being such a fucking prude. And then she goes, I am not doing promo. She tells her agent, her agent tells them, one of Sacha Baron Cohen's little friends calls her up and says, you know, there's only really 5 big movie studios in Hollywood and we can ruin your reputation with all of them.
I felt threatened. I felt scared. My career was everything to me. And now it felt like these assholes were trying to take it away because I wasn't doing what they wanted. In my mind, this alleged threat was probably worse than the incident in South Africa itself. I sat in my home office looking at the Hollywood sign, feeling petrified.
So ultimately, Tabitha does part ways with him, as does all of WME.
But like, I don't know if it's over this.
Yeah, I don't know what it's over either. But God, fuck that guy. Like, she really is like, he clearly gets off on making people feel like sexually degraded and uncomfortable.
And she like really covers her bases to be like, this just is what happened. And I felt potentially harassed. And it's like, no, you were being harassed. Like, this was full on sexual assault.
So now it's 2015. She's at this place called the Biggest Loser Resort, which I don't understand how medically anyone could even recommend working out for 8 hours a day for a full week to try to lose weight. Like, why would anybody think that that would be sustainable or helpful?
I don't know.
But she's trying to lose weight and she has decided that she just wants to lose the weight. And she's like, I'm happy with myself and I love myself, or I want to love myself. But she's like, it's dishonest to say, just learn to be happy and love yourself, when the reason she has gained so much weight is because she is engaging in very self-destructive behaviors.
And then she decides that this is the year that she's going to get a boyfriend.
And this is where she finally admits, I didn't lose my virginity until I was 35 years old.
I was a late bloomer. I was terrified. I'd kissed more people on screen than I'd ever kissed in real life. And seeing as I'd waited this long, I wanted to really love the person I was going to sleep with. I was quite shy and reserved. I wasn't as sexually as confident as Fat Amy and Robin.
I mean, that was also her character in How to Be Single, opposite Dakota Johnson and Leslie Mann. So at this point, she is a movie star and people are hitting on her constantly. Like, hot waiters are giving her their numbers. And everyone's like, why aren't you just fucking these hot guys? And she's like, I don't know. But the secret is she's nervous.
So she's terrified to like finally have sex.
She tells this one story that she gets invited by a friend to a tech billionaire's party. It's Victorian era themed.
So everyone is in these elaborate outfits and there's like jousting on the lawn. And everyone has a room in this mansion to stay the night because it's kind of out there. And so, like, it's just the most elaborate party she's ever been to.
And then at 2 a.m., they start walking around with candy on a tray. And she's like, oh, cool, candy. And somebody's like, that's Molly.
And then they're like, it's for the orgy. And she's like, the what?
And so she like, freaks out and goes to her room. And her friends are like, I don't know, man. That would have been a good place to start. But is that crazy that tech billionaires really are throwing orgy parties?
With, like, Hollywood celebrities. It's what we've always assumed.
In 2014, she gets offered $2 million to spend a weekend with a Jordanian prince. As part of the deal, you're allowed to bring your own security. And this is funny. She's like, what would that do in the Middle East? Like, oh, they're going to listen to your soldiers. But she's like, but then I heard that you're kind of expected to have sex with them. And I was like,
what did you think it was going to be?
What else would the money be for?
And she's like, I've heard that lots of Hollywood actresses do this. And once again, just as I suspected. So then she meets this guy named Mickey. Mickey pursued me. He was sexy and passionate and had money so he could chase me around the world. He would take me to the nicest restaurants. He must have thought I was playing hard to get, but really I was just innocent. And finally, she has sex with him and it's awesome.
And they have this amazing relationship and they're having so much fun.
And then she finds out he is a recovering drug addict and he was a bit embellishy, like kind of a lowball when he talked about the facts of his addiction. He's actually been to rehab 17 times and at some point in their relationship, he relapses.
Well, not just randomly at some point. They're going to Dubai and she offers him a sleeping pill.
Oh, yeah.
And she's like, then suddenly he was acting weird. And she's like, I guess I had never met an addict before, so I didn't know. And I was like, Rebel, I understand that there's a lot of her life that I feel like she's very sheltered about. And naive, because I think she is a lonely person. Like, we were talking about why this book is so interesting. And I think it is because she's an A-list star with no A-list friends.
Yeah.
So she's like on the list to get into the party. And then she has like no bridges to maintain. So she's like, yeah, I'll tell you about these orgies.
Okay. But she does have Hollywood friends, but she just like maintains this sense of like outside looking in.
But what I was getting to is, if you're 35 years old with an addict boyfriend, it is actually on you to like not know to offer a drug addict.
I guess I disagree. I think that it's on a drug addict to say no thank you.
I guess, but for her to be like, I've never met a drug addict before, that's not fucking true. You've never gotten to, like, you're not in LA as a Hollywood star having never met a drug addict.
Yeah, but like every time you go to a restaurant with an alcoholic, the waiter still comes over and says, can I get anybody drinks? And the alcoholic has to say, like, just a water, please.
I guess I just find it odd to be 35 and be like, I just had no idea. I do think at some point you need to like open your eyes and find out what people are going through. To be 35 and not know that it's a big no-no to not offer addicts. Like, yeah, it's on him to stay sober. If you love somebody deeply, I don't think you should offer them drugs when they're trying to stay sober.
Yeah, but she didn't know him that well at this point.
No, they've been dating 6 months.
Yeah, I don't know. I see both sides of it.
Like, I don't think it's her fault he relapsed, but I do think it is indicative of her weird, naive, shut-off character.
Yes.
I think she's so self-absorbed. I think it's like a weird evidence of how self-absorbed you must be.
Yeah, she has a lot of self-absorption and being like, I'm weird, I'm a late bloomer, I'm this.
Like she's just like, I didn't have time to learn about addiction because I was so busy, like I was fat. Like that really is her thing.
Yeah.
That was her trauma and she couldn't look past it. I do think it's weird. It's like a weirdly insular way to exist. What is the last age you think you would have offered a boyfriend who you knew had been to rehab drugs?
Because she doesn't do drugs, so I don't think she thought of them that way.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think she thought of her sleeping pills. Like, she won't smoke pot with Seth Rogen.
Yeah.
Or Snoop Dogg, who've both offered her joints at different parts of this book. So I don't think she thinks of her sleeping pills as drug doing. And so I don't think she clocked that she was offering a drug addict drugs. And especially because I don't think that he was that honest in the beginning of their relationship about how serious his addiction was.
She knew that he had been to rehab 17 times.
She says she didn't know it was 17 at that point. She knew he had been to rehab. But that could mean anything.
A few times.
And I think that that is like indicative of her like inexperience in relationships, the way she like does not consider necessarily the other person's perspective most of the time. She's like very much absorbed in her, like, I'm new. I don't know what's going on. I don't understand relationships. I don't know any of this, you know?
So she ends up breaking up with him because of his addiction. I have so much sympathy for him. I get the firm grip of addiction. It can have a hold on me too, just in a different way. She later breaks up with a different guy for being an alcoholic. And she's like, I'm a role model. I can't be with an addict. And I'm like, I guess I think she does talk about addiction in a way that you don't often see from people who are like.
I agree with that. Like the way that she's like, I just simply couldn't be with him. He was an addict. I'm like, okay, I don't think that's really fair. He was obviously not prioritizing the relationship. She was hoping he would get sober and come back to her. And then he was like dating an Instagram model. So like, I get that you guys couldn't be together, but.
I guess I think to be like, I'm a role model.
She's like, kids look up to me. I'm not dating an alcoholic.
So 2016, everything's quiet. She has no boyfriend. And she's in this, after the Bauer article came out, trashing her spirit and her authenticity. She has no job opportunities.
Like many rejected film stars, she goes to the stage. She's having a great time in London's West End. She thinks about quitting the business altogether. I'd look up at the sky and think, should I just move back to Australia and become a lawyer and get out of the limelight? But then I'd get onto that stage and hear the audience laugh, and I'd see the young people after the show at the stage door who looked up to me.
So she wins the Bauer lawsuit. The following year, 2017, was the biggest professional year of my life to date. I won the defamation case. My reputation was restored, and I filmed 3 movies back to back to back. Pitch Perfect 3, Isn't It Romantic, and The Hustle for a whopping $20 million.
She also talks about how she got $10 million for Pitch Perfect 3, especially the jump from her $65,000 Pitch Perfect 1. And she says essentially after Pitch Perfect 2, not essentially, literally, they came to her and a couple of the other characters and said, okay, so you guys are out for Pitch Perfect 3. We're just going to do a new era of the Bellas starring Hailee Steinfeld. And they were like, what are you saying right now? I love Hailee, don't get me wrong. She's a stellar performer, but she had just joined us in the second film as the newbie and she wasn't part of the original DNA of the franchise. That's the sweetest way to say she could never have led this franchise.
Also, she couldn't have. Basically, they cut him out and then luckily,
They did like a market research thing.
And it turned out everybody, the thing they loved about Pitch Perfect was like the people in the movie.
Yeah. So
it wasn't just the concept.
And like Rebel Wilson was everyone's numero uno favorite. And so then they all started negotiating for Pitch Perfect 3. And she actually says she tried to like band together and do what the cast of Friends did. But there was like too many moving parts, so they couldn't really do it. But she says everyone got a lot of money.
Then she does Isn't It Romantic, where she stars in her own rom-com. And then she does The Hustle with Anne Hathaway.
And for those two, she produced them. She says this year she made $20 million.
But it's exhausting. That's a lot to do back to it. She's like, in between each one, I had 3 days off. So after that year, she's like, okay, I've done really well. I need a fucking break. I'm exhausted. I'm about to hit the ground.
She gets mono. She like gets a concussion. It was a lot.
Okay, this is the part of the book where I'm finally off the struggle bus. I'm riding on a jet ski at a full speed off Bora Bora. So then she like has an entire chapter about how fun it is to be rich.
Yeah, she's like, I had so much money and I really wanted to spend a year. She says, inspired by Shonda Rhimes' Year of Yes, she went in for a year of fun. 2018, the whole point was to just do things that are fun. And she worked a little. I think she did 1 month.
She did Jojo Rabbit, which is like not nothing.
It's not nothing, but she only worked for a month.
Yeah.
And she makes this friend named Carly, who is just like such a great Hollywood rich girl best friend.
Because she keeps being like, why don't you just ask if we could go for free? So they go to Bora Bora and get free rooms. Then they go to this like spa in Austria and get free rooms. Like she's just like, I bet we could go for free. Let me ask.
Yeah, it's so wild because it doesn't feel exploitive because she's not being like, Rebel, buy me stuff. She's being like, Rebel, use your name to get free stuff and bring me as your plus one.
Yeah, it's just so fun.
And like Carly loves to like just party and flirt, and she like really helps Rebel like kind of get out of her cage. They go to Aspen. They meet all these Snapchat guys. Carly ends up marrying one of them. They like make these lists of what they hope their partners will be. And one of these Snapchat guys that they're going on dates with meets all of her qualities. And she's like, wow, Carly manifested love.
I definitely succeeded in my year of fun. If I dedicated a whole year to now finding love, could I manifest it?
So 2019 is her year of love. And she decides to say yes to every date. And she goes on like 50 dates.
She starts listening to Love and Sex podcasts. It turns out she had never even had an orgasm. But she's saying yes to all these dates. And she ends up going with this guy, Jacob Bush, heir to the Bush fortune, who's also pretty hot. They have like a lot of fun dating stuff. And they're dating for 6 months and they're having sex and it's great. And then it turns out he's an alcoholic.
So she breaks up with him. And then she's at this tennis tournament and she sees a tennis player. And she's like, hold on. I am mesmerized by that gal. They start texting. They're never really in the same city, but it's very flirty.
And intense. You know how lesbians can be.
I date men. I have sex with men. So what is this? It hits me like an ace hits the line in the service box. Pow.
She also decides, she goes to this really intense spa in Austria where she decides that she needs to like treat her body better. And she has to like love herself and be healthy because the way she's treating herself is not loving. I decide at this point that next year, 2020, would be my year of health. So then she has this on and off thing for 3 years with this tennis player where she also gets back together with Jacob Bush and she's obsessed with this girl who just does not like her back.
Dude, this tennis player, I think, loved the attention.
Or maybe she just wasn't comfortable being out. She'd only ever had one other gay experience.
No, because I think the way the tennis player like leads her on and then even when they're like in secret, will like meet up with her or not meet up with her. I don't know. Maybe you're right.
It really hurts Rebel because they're texting all the time and then she'll like cut her off and then she goes back and then they finally have sex and then the girl's like, I never want to see you again. At one point, she like flies to Australia to see her for the weekend and the girl's like, oh yeah, well I lost, so I'm going home. She's addicted to tennis. She loves tennis.
Dude, tennis players are so obsessed with tennis. It's crazy. Like, get another hobby. My heart is crushed. It's like I've lost a Grand Slam final.
She also does successfully lose weight. She starts going to Gwyneth Paltrow's doctor and realizing the mind-body connection. And she starts doing all these emotional purges where for 12 minutes, she writes down everything she feels and then she burns it to help like release.
That sounds really nice.
But she's just like starting a healthier habit and being less extreme and just being like, I have to be in a calorie deficit where I have to work out and I have to eat less. And she ends up losing 77 pounds and she feels really healthy and great.
2020, so this is her year of health. She is like having a great year. I've done incredible things. The waters have been murky up until now, muddy like the ocean after a big storm. But now things mentally are clearing up. The waters are becoming still and I can almost see through the sand beneath. She doesn't want to work that much in 2020 because work causes stress and this is her year of health. Luckily, 2020, if you recall, not a lot of people remember this. It was not a big year for work.
She does get to present at the Oscars though. Like just in the nick of time, she's presenting at the Oscars, presenting at BAFTA. Timothée Chalamet and Brad Pitt are like, what's up, little lady?
I think it's really important to note that she presented at the Oscars as one of the cats from Cats because she was in the film Cats.
And they knew it bombed.
And she loved it. She's like, I quite like the film and I think the artistry is incredible. Tom Hooper's an exceptional director, but you can't deny that people seem to be weirded out by the special effects. In particular, making jokes about whether our cats had buttholes. Ah, just that one hiccup. You know when you're watching a movie and no one can get past the buttholes? It would have been a perfect film if not for that butthole problem. Should we watch it for the Patreon?
Yes.
Okay.
She also goes to the Vanity Fair after party. And then after that, she goes to another after party that's hosted by Madonna's manager. And apparently when you leave, everybody gets a free clutch from Gucci. That's a crazy parting gift.
I get why people want to go to these things. Again, the way she reports on them, I feel like a lot of people would think it's gauche to be like, and then I went to these parties and I had free hamburgers and then I got a Gucci clutch. And it's like, no, I wanted to know what you get when you walk out the door. And it's apparently a Gucci clutch.
It's very interesting stuff to me.
I agree. I think to myself, I've made it. I've really made it.
So then COVID hits and she moves back home and she kind of gets close with her family again and stays fit and stays active.
Her and her sisters all just like take lots and lots of long walks together. She also like has this pretty consistent like back and forth in her mind of when things are going well. She's like, maybe I should just stay the fat rebel that people have made very successful, or should I like put myself first and just like focus on my mental and physical health? And then she like through COVID is able to, and like, again, I think she does a good job of acknowledging that this was not a good time, but during this time she was able to really focus on herself.
So then she decides she wants to make a baby. So she goes to a new female doctor. She does 3 rounds of egg retrieval. She gets 18 eggs. She finds a sperm donor. She gets a ton of cum.
She buys tons of cum. And it turns out she's only able to get 1 embryo.
But she finds a surrogate. They implant it. All things go. And in the meantime, she falls in love with this woman, Ramona, that she set up with.
She ends up getting a second embryo after another retrieval. And the first embryo does not implant. And then the second one does, and she finds out as she's starting this relationship with this woman, Ramona, who she meets through a friend of a friend. They've both had similar tumultuous love lives. And this guy that they're friends with is like, you guys really would get along. And as soon as they start talking, they just like connect like magnets. Mm-hmm. And so around this time, again, she implants the second embryo in another surrogate. It does implant. So this relationship, they have 1 week together before she gets stuck back in Australia for visa stuff. So that they have 1 week of like super romance, then 7 weeks apart, and then they come back and then they just go like headfirst into like, we're in a relationship. And then she tells Ramona that she's pregnant via surrogate. And then Ramona's like, yeah, I'll raise this baby with you. After about a year, they get engaged. She's like so worried throughout the book that if she starts losing weight, she'll not be funny. She really only gets not funny when she's in love. The way she keeps calling Ramona my Disney princess, I can't with Disney adults, man. We left out a lot of Disney from this book, but she is like a full-blown Disney adult. She proposes at Disneyland.
They end up having a little baby named Royce. They love her. They think that their surrogate's drinking, but good news, it's a false alarm.
So the baby is happy and healthy. At one point, a Australian tabloid guy wants to out them as in a same-sex relationship. Even though they've been going to red carpets as a couple, it just wasn't like fully public info. She had told her family kind of one at a time. It just wasn't what she expected because she said, you know, I've always liked men. I've always been attracted to men. So it felt easier to just be with men. You know, her mom was very happy with it. Her family was very happy with it. Ramona's family was not as accepting. So that was hard. And now they're a family. Pretty cute.
Thoughts?
I really liked this book. I can't speak for everyone, but I think that there are some topics in here that people take very personally. And I think she did the best she could with them. She like gave us some fucking tea. I think fuck Sacha Baron Cohen. Can't wait to watch Cats.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
I think it's like a 3.75. Just because when I think about what a great book is, I'm like, it's not a great book, but I think it like hits all the notes for what a celebrity memoir is. Like, this is like a bestseller at the airport.
I think it's not a great book, but it's a very good celebrity memoir.
I agree. I also would love to have 2 to 3 worm teenies with her because I'm like, she'll tell me fucking anything.
Yes. I would love to have like 4 worm teenies with her because I really feel like
it doesn't take a lot for this woman to be like, okay, and then you want to know who's really a freak on set.
Yes. I do want to know who's really a freak on set.
And who do you think is like a freak in the sheets that we love with our hearts?
Oh, we love the 5-star reviewing wormies.
Thank you so much to the gorgeous, ever stunning 5-star reviewing wormies. Thank you, grateful Darlene. No. Do you know who's grateful? Me, grateful Ashley, for your 5-star review. Thank you, Natty Coer. The amount that I adore this review is unnatty, the least natural thing out there. It is through the fucking roof, built on all 10 cylinders. Thank you, Anna Lexana. This is the most anatomically gorgeous review in the lexicon. I don't know if any of those words are the correct use of them. I think they're not, but you get what I mean, and I love you. Lol. Oh, you think this podcast has you lolin'? Well, these reviews have me lovin' every worm in town. The number one Killers fan? Okay, well, let me just tell you, I feel the bones of this review on my bones, and it's perfect. Thank you, IMB. I am appreciative of you. Thank you, Zoss Lover. Well, I'm a this review lover. Thank you so much. I adore you. Thank you, Fierce. This review is simply fierce, and I appreciate you oh so much. And that is all for this week. Thank you, guys. I freaking adore you to the moon and then across the sun. And then when the moon crosses back, I don't really understand what an eclipse is either, but my love for you is eclipsed by friggin' nothing.